This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I'm Michael Daventry, and coming up on this programme... Ukraine is the only news story in town at the moment, and in this week's episode we speak to eyewitnesses, charities, aid agencies and journalists to help you make sense of how Jews in the country and around the world are being affected. If you've watched TV news or picked up a newspaper or been on any news website or scrolled through your social media feeds, you'll have seen plenty over the past week about the situation in Ukraine. This week's episode of the Jewish News Podcast isn't going to repeat the mostly excellent journalism that's already out there, but we do want to help you build a picture of the effects this crisis is having on Jewish people both in Ukraine and here in Britain. Later we'll hear from the Jewish Agency on what it is doing to get people out of Ukraine over the nearest border and about how many Jews have asked about starting a new life in Israel. We'll also speak to my colleagues, Jewish news journalists, who will help to give an idea of Ukraine's Jewish story and some thoughts on that thorny question of sanctions on Russia, which could affect the Jewish community here in the UK. But the only place to begin this episode is by hearing from people on the ground as this Russian invasion gathers pace. In a moment, you're going to hear two different voices. They're both running charities helping Jews in Ukraine. One of them is Rafael Kruskal, the chief executive of the Tikva Children's Home in the Black Sea port town of Odessa. The other is Volodymyr Vyzotsky, who's in Kyiv and runs a charity connected to World Jewish Relief that helps people who are elderly or find it difficult to leave their homes at the best of times because of mobility problems. We spoke to those two men separately on Wednesday morning, but you're going to hear them together, talking one after the other. The second voice belongs to Volodymyr Vyzotsky in Kyiv. The first is Rafael Kruskal, who decided hours after the war broke out that the only thing his school could do was to evacuate.
On Thursday, since the invasion began, it was Wednesday night, we decided that we've got to get people out of the city. Now, we were worried to get the kids out and to go with tens of buses out of the city because we were worried about bombing on the roads and the safety of taking them out into a safe area would be many hours of travel. So and on the first day they were already bombing. They were trying to bomb all the army sites which are next to the roads, etc., and the airports. So we said we're going to stay in town and look for borders at least to get as many people out as possible. We at that point realized that we're going to have to split the groups.
Well, what's happening right now is that we're basically under several, levels of threats. The first one is the aerial strikes. So the rockets fly in mostly at night and they hit random targets, including, of course, certain military objects, but mostly residential areas, hospitals, kindergartens, schools. It's happening all over Ukraine, and Kyiv is not an exclusion, so, and it's not an exception. So basically the northwestern part of the Kyiv outskirts, so the suburbs, the northwestern suburbs, are under constant attack for the last 5 days, I suppose. Basically, these are the communities that we serve as an organization.
We found the border, which was emptier, and we sent one bus, and then once one bus went through, we sent another four buses and a fifth bus during the evening, and we managed to get out about 250 people. The last bus, they already told anyone over 18, that means even students could be in 11th grade, children in 11th grade from the homes, 18 to 60, it wouldn't be allowed out because there's forced conscription to the army. So we managed to get them back from the border to Odessa.
We are now experiencing severe difficulties in actually addressing our participants and, doing something because there is no logistics. The roads are mostly closed. The bridges that have been used to, move around the area are also partly destroyed. And so basically it's kind of, a certain degree of blockade,
Now, during the night, there was bombing again. They were bombing the Odessa airport, and when one bomb landed very close to the girls' home, about a half mile away from the girls' home, and the girls were very shocked, and they were crying, and they were traumatized. We had a security meeting during the night, and at 7 o'clock in the morning, we came to the decision that it's safer even to go on the roads than to stay in Odessa. So we told everybody that within 2 hours, we'd like to leave Odessa to pack up the community, everybody. We'd like to leave. And it was very moving, as you can imagine, to leave a place where we've invested, I've invested 22 years of my life, and we built an unbelievable community. A community was wiped out by the communists. And it was a very moving and moment when we left Odessa with the children, but it's a life-saving mission.
The whole city, the whole nation is now, you know, rallied up, allied towards helping the needy and evacuating the, you know, the vulnerable people, the vulnerable groups like children, elderly, and women. But unfortunately, many elderly are, they're isolated and nothing can be done to evacuate them. Many elderly are simply low or non-mobile at all, and they cannot, you know, relocate themselves and even to the shelter. So we're on the brink of a humanitarian catastrophe.
And we started going on the way. Every 70 miles, we stopped to find out which ways were the safest, where the bombing was, which streets were being mined by the Ukrainians because they didn't want the Russians to get closer, which airports were being bombed by the Russians or army sites, which could hamper out the way that how we drove. We stopped again and again.
In Kyiv, it's more or less okay. You can get food, you can get water, you can get stuff, you can communicate to people. Locally, in small towns, in small localities, it's much, much harder, and the communities are smaller, and many people who fled, well, some people fled, left, and those were, you know, young people, mostly, who could have been able to help, but now the communities are, sort of, you know, left to themselves, and we are now waiting for at least some pause in this horror to, you know, to provide some assistance, to at least find out what's going on.
We stopped at a petrol station where we had kiddush, and it was also very, very overwhelming. People crying, you know, no one would believe that outside in the middle of a petrol station, in the middle of nowhere, in Ukraine, you've got 400 people, kids and children. I mean, remind us of evacuations and times gone by, times which we hoped we'd never have to repeat. Things which I heard from my father, my grandparents that were in Bergen-Belsen when they ran away. My grandfather wrote a book when he ran away after Kristallnacht from Germany.
Our main target audience are elderly, Jewish elderly, mostly lonely elderly, and elderly with disabilities, with chronic illnesses. So these are many people who are not like self-sustained at all. And currently we're, we hear and we receive information that many people are homebound, like they used to be, but now it's kind of different because these social services are at full stretch and not everybody can get help and attention, you know, as soon as they need it.
Of course, the buses demanded more money, even though they had taken an exorbitant price to take us to where we are, but they realized our pressure. They said, if you don't give us money now, more money, they wanted us to double it. We didn't double it, but we were negotiating on Shabbos how much it's going to cost us to continue saving the lives of our people and our children.
You know, there are certain cases that are like similar. For example, for several of our participants in Boyarka, Boyarka is a town near Kyiv. It's like 20 kilometers, and it's also under fire, and they expect street warfare as well. if the enemy, you know, gets there. So for those people, for some people in Boyerka who are, again, for example, diabetic, they are now looking for medicine, insulin, and so every person who has any sort of health problem currently is under huge risk.
But now they're settled in more or less into this place. We're trying to show some kind of normality. We're trying to we've started the lessons. We try to give the kids some kind of feeling of that everything's normal. It should be like a summer camp, even though it isn't. Of course, there's a huge amount of tension that we have children and community members who have family in Kharkov, in Kherson, in different places. And this, there's a huge amount of tension, that people crying. It's a very emotional period.
I want just to add one more thing, that we're kind of helpless here as well for the time being, again, because of these logistical issues. But I'm sure that once, I sincerely believe that once there is a ceasefire agreement and once there is this stop of shooting and stop of, you know, bombings, there will be, I don't know, loads of work in terms of, you know, getting back to normal. The huge work that needs to be done to get back to normal in terms of infrastructure, in terms of people's homes and so on. I am feeling terrible because I'm currently not able to do a lot for the people I'm supposed to care about, you know. And this is something that really, well, it drives me mad a little. But I hope that today, tomorrow, we'll start doing something on the ground once the situation is clear. Because most of our volunteers are women, and it's all very dangerous, and all men are now engaged in defensive stuff. So even our volunteers who had cars, they are now involved in absolutely other tasks.
The voice of Volodymyr Vysotsky in Kiev ending that account there, you also heard from Rafael Kruskal. Another harrowing account came from Rabbi Yakov Bleich, one of Ukraine's chief rabbis. He fought back tears in a BBC interview after being asked about his feelings when he saw footage of Jews praying in Kiev's underground bunkers.
Difficult. Difficult. I've been there 32 years. I gave, you know, I'm 57. I came there when I was 25, built up a community. I was there for 2 years under the Soviet Union. And then from Ukrainian independence, we started to build and blossom. This was building up their personalities, building them up, and to see everything that you built over so many years. And I'm not only talking for myself as a chief rabbi, I'm talking for every single rabbi in that country. To see your community disintegrating and being bombed in front of you. I mean, I'm telling you that many of the rabbis have, you know, swore that they'll never leave, they'll stay. And they're running because nobody ever dreamt, you know, that the carnage and the bombing will look the way it's looking now. And I personally had to leave because of my own security. I had to leave right when the war was starting. I couldn't stay there for many reasons. One of the reasons is that I'm not particularly one of Putin's favorites, and I was on one of his lists. However, I have not stopped. I haven't slept since this began. This has been definitely the most harrowing experience, and I feel like I'm there with them, even though I'm not, but I've just been with them since the beginning. And, you know, I just hope that this thing ends.
Rabbi Yakov Bleich. Now, there's a monumental effort underway to provide aid to people in Ukraine and to the refugees who've made it across the border. The funds are being pledged in huge amounts. This week, on Wednesday, an appeal by World Jewish Relief had raised over £1 million in less than a week. The Genesis Philanthropy Group, who sponsors this podcast, announced a fund of $10 million. That's around £7.5 million. And then there are other charities and organisations providing longer-term help. One of them is the Jewish Agency of Israel. Roman Polonsky is the Jewish Agency Regional Director for a region that covers the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, and Germany. He told us about the work his colleagues have started at border crossings with Ukraine to assist Jews who want to make Aliyah, as well as the help the agency is providing to Jewish groups in Ukraine who've decided to stay.
First of all, with outbreak of the war, we opened the hotline together with Fellowship for Christians and Jews. And we received during 72 hours, we received more than 7,000 calls. And about 5,000 of them, they were calls which people interested in Aliyah. They asked us about questions about Aliyah. And just to put it in proportion, in the whole 2021, we had 3,000 Olim from Ukraine, and now it's more than 5,000 people who inquires about Aliyah. And I can say that our initial estimation was that in this first wave of Aliyah, there will be 3,000 people. But right now, we think that it will be more closer to 10,000 people in the first wave of Aliyah. Now, this is not an easy process, first of all, because of regulation in Ukraine. As probably you know, men ages 18, 60, they cannot leave the country because they are drafted to the army. And it means that families are split, they tiered. And wives, they have to decide whether they stay in Ukraine or they go out with their small children and with their elderly parents. And it's a very easy and very heartbreaking decision. So they come to the border. And how they come to the border? We have two places in Ukraine with a capacity of 1,600 beds. And people come to these places, and then with buses, they come to the border. We have our shlichim, our emissaries, in four countries, in Poland, in Hungary, in Romania, and in Moldova. And these people, they meet these refugees, and they provide them with basic needs, with what they need immediately, including sometimes clothes and, of course, medicine and food. We accommodate them in the places that we rented in advance. And then we connect them to the consulate, to Nativ, to Prime Minister office, who is responsible for eligibility for Aliyah. And only those who have visas, they can go to Israel. Now, this is not an easy question as well, because in order to get visa, you have to provide some documents. And normally, it's a process which takes time, and people, they do it. But in the situation of war, when they fled their homes, often with only one bag in their, and then some, you know, some cat or some dog in their laps. So that's a situation when they usually don't have these documents. And Prime Minister office is much more flexible right now. They understand the situation, but still, we think how to expedite this process and how to help these people. Anyway, it doesn't matter. They make Aliyah, they don't make Aliyah, they decide to go to Israel or not. We are there in order to help them and to save their lives and to ease their plight. And we have our shlichim, our emissaries. We send them with diplomatic passports, which give them some ability to be more, you know, flexible and more free. Going to the border and meeting these people. And we have also local volunteers. We need, for this case, we need local volunteers in these countries who speak Russian. I can give you an example. In Budapest, we just held a winter camp for our counselors. And there were 120 counselors in this winter camp. And it was absolutely unique and very, very, very nice experience for 1 week. And then they were supposed to go back. They were supposed to go back on 24th of February when this war started. So Ukrainians, they couldn't go back. 60 Ukrainians are stuck in Budapest, like Ukrainians in other countries, including Israel, they are stuck, they cannot go back. But we use them in Budapest, at least in Hungarian, as volunteers in our work with these refugees who come. And this is very useful and very needed. We also dealing with strengthening the resilience of Jewish communities in this difficult time. This is really could be very dangerous because Now many civilians, they have weapons which were distributed by Ukrainian government in order to resist these attacks, and we fear that once shortage of food will be will begin, then there could be also looting. And that's why we, through our security fund, which was established 10 years ago after attack on Toulouse, we are now distributing, we are going to distribute $1.5 million for every Jewish community and organization in Ukraine in order to strengthen their security. And we give them, we'll give them this grants from $2,500 up to $10,000 for these biggest organizations, in order that they can hire guards and they can strengthen their security working in this very difficult situation.
That was Roman Polonsky from the Jewish Agency. So, let's now take a step back from that harrowing testimony out of an active war zone and talk a little bit more broadly about Judaism in Ukraine, a country in a region where Jews have lived for centuries. And of course, it won't surprise anyone listening to this when I say that this Russian invasion isn't the first trauma endured by Jews in this part of the world. With me now is the Jewish News' Stephen Oreshchuk, who's here to talk about that history. And Stephen, I suppose, given Ukraine's position on the map in a region which has previously been part of Russia and Poland and Lithuania, there's quite a rich Jewish history to draw upon, stretching right back to the Middle Ages here.
There's a huge history. It's the seat of Hasidism, and still today there are tens of thousands of Hasidic Jews make pilgrimage to places like Uman to see the grave of Rabbi Nachman every Rosh Hashanah. It's also a seat of Zionism. There was several of the most influential Zionist thinkers and activists came out of Ukraine. Lots of the big Zionist youth movements that we know today originated in Ukraine. The history goes back centuries, as you rightly say. In the past century, the 20th century, lots of that Jewish history and activity were suppressed under the blanket of communism. And one of the things that people today hear a lot about is the resurgence of Ukraine's collective Jewish identity.
Well, let's talk about communism in just a second, but if we sort of go on a sequential historical order, these shifting borders that I was talking about, so when I mentioned Russia, Poland, Lithuania, Germany was a big factor, of course, when the Second World War came and the big Russian invasion of the Soviet Union, Operation Barbarossa, meant that there were German occupiers of Ukraine. Let's talk about Babyn Yar in particular, which has been on the lips of many people in the past week. What happened there in September 1941?
It was one of the first and worst massacres of the Holocaust. Over a weekend, the Jewish residents of the city of Kiev were ordered to come to a ravine, Babyn Yar, outside the city centre. They weren't told what it was about. In fact, if anything, they heard that it was about simply them being relocated. So they just thought they were going from where they were to a different place, and they were shot. I can't remember the exact figures, but it was around about 33,700 in 2 days. And they were shot on the edge of a ravine, and their bodies fell into the ravine, and that became a mass grave. When I lived in Ukraine about 10 years ago, I visited Babyn Yar before there was any kind of memorial complex, learning site. And it was the eeriest, one of the strangest, most disturbing experiences of my life. And I, as a journalist, I'm very rarely lost for words, but I have struggled to describe what it felt like walking around there. And I would like to go again, but it's just been bombed.
Well, it has just been bombed. There was a Russian rocket strike, which was aimed at a massive television transmitter, which is adjacent to the park in which there is now a Babyn Yar memorial. And that was part of the outrage because this is not just a memorial, but as you've just said, a mass grave. where 33,700 people are believed to be lying. And there hasn't ever been any sort of effort, has there, Stephen, to try and to recover them? They are all still there.
It is a mass grave, and in later months during the war, others were added to that mass grave. So it's important to say that there aren't just Jewish souls at that place, but that there has been extensive efforts to make that a site of learning, a site of archival history. For Ukrainian children to come and learn about what happened in the Holocaust, because for decades after Babyn Yar, in other words, throughout the Soviet era, there was a generic memorial to those who perished there. It wasn't specifically aimed at... it didn't even specifically mention Jews. And the Ukrainian president, Zelensky, has made it a focus of his presidency to pay tribute to those who died at Babyn Yar and to put a focus on it.
So can we talk about, you were there 10 years ago, before this focus that President Zelensky helped to accelerate began. And I know you say it's difficult to put into words what it was that you felt there, but can you at least describe what the place looked like before it became the memorial park that it was today? What was it that was so, so eerie and chilling about the place?
No birds sang, but there were trees, and there was the wind felt differently. It's very strange to describe it. You know what's gone on there, and I don't know if I'd have felt that way if I'd have just been walking my dog along this grassy ravine. I don't know, but I suspect I'd have felt that something was wrong. And I'm about as far from superstitious as it's possible to get, and I'm not religious. So, but I just felt the hairs on the back of my neck stand on end, and I was completely alone, but I didn't feel like I was. So.
And part of the reason why it was unmarked or unacknowledged in the way that it was 10 years ago was because of what happened after the end of the Second World War, when Ukraine became part of the Soviet Union and fell under communist rule, and there was an active attempt, really, if not to wipe out Jews like happened under the Nazi occupation, there was certainly suppression of Judaism going on in Ukraine, wasn't there?
There was, and Jews didn't feel that they were able to express their Judaism, their Jewish identity, and it was something to be hidden. Rather than celebrated, and still today they're coming out of that. So a chap I was speaking to this week, he was telling me that his good friend is called Mikhail Goldachev, which is a very typical Ukrainian Russian name, but actually he's called Moishe Goldstein. So there's still a layer of hiding it, but slowly there's been a long process over the last 10, 20, 30 years to bring that out. And the number of Ukrainian Jews is unknown because in part it depends on how you define Jewish in Ukraine. There are hundreds of thousands. I would say a significant minority of the population will have somewhere a Jewish, I don't know, grandparent or whatever. The number of synagogue-going Jews who are part of the community is still significant, but less. But it's something that people are exploring and discovering all the time.
And one of the things that we heard earlier in the podcast from Rabbi Yaakov Bleich, who's one of the chief rabbis of Ukraine, was that process that you're talking about of what happened after the Second World War and after the Cold War ended, where I guess there was a sort of renaissance of sort among Ukrainian Jews. And while not necessarily all of them were observant, there were a lot of them who were discovering their Jewish heritage and were beginning to discover to learn about themselves a little bit more, not necessarily going to shul and observing Shabbat immediately, but there was a journey going on there, and that's what Yaakov Bleich was talking about, engaging with them for the past 30 years. I suppose it really was a renaissance of sorts, wasn't it, ever since the Cold War ended?
It was and is. You can see it physically. There are Jewish community buildings. There are events going on. There are Jewish populations in several of the big cities. But just taking Kyiv, for instance, there are numerous synagogues. There's a Jewish culture center. There's a kosher shop. There's even a kosher hotel for visitors who come to the city from outside of Ukraine who need somewhere to spend Shabbat. I believe it was about 2016, 2017, the project began to construct a Jewish village outside of the city centre, whose the name of the village escapes me at the moment. But this is a very active community, and what happened in 2014, many of the listeners will know. Russia supported separatists in the eastern Donbass region. Two big cities out there, Donetsk and Luhansk, both had very big Jewish communities, very active Jewish communities, and they lost everything. The bulk of those communities came to Kyiv and had to set up from scratch. So they set up their own culture centres, their own synagogues. The Kyiv Jewish community supported them in doing so. These were internal refugees. And now, of course, Kyiv is being encircled and attacked by rockets. So a population from Donbass that had become refugees, made their way to Kyiv, been supported, grown from scratch, is now having that rebuilding process literally destroyed, turned into rubble. So where will they be forced next? Where will they have to regrow next?
It's an impossible final question, but what will happen next? What can we speak of the Ukrainian Jewish community in a month, in a week, let alone in a year?
I wish I had a crystal ball. My family, as you know, is Ukrainian. I've been living and breathing this story for 2 weeks. I've hardly slept. I've been reading the news like I never have before, and I've been in news 10 years. It's very, very difficult to write about this whilst keeping objectivity, but I'm trying. I think the wider plan for Ukraine is that Vladimir Putin wants to install a Ukrainian puppet regime in order for Ukraine to become once again a client state of Russia. I also think he wants to station missiles and troops along the border with the EU. As regards the Jewish community, they'll survive. Many will go to Israel. Lots of younger Ukrainian Jews had already gone to Israel. Other European countries and the US will take Jewish refugees in, I'm sure. Whether these big, thriving, liberal Jewish centres like Kharkiv and Kyiv and Odessa thrive and continue to exist in the way that we know, I doubt.
The Jewish News is Stephen Oreshchuk. Thank you. Now, the Russian invasion has led to a backlash, not just in Western countries, but right around the world. It seems like everyone is cutting their ties with anything connected to Russia. Governments and global bodies have announced sanctions on President Putin and his closest associates. Russian banks are being cut off from some of the main systems used to transfer money. And brands that you and I will immediately recognise, BP, Netflix, FIFA, to name just three, have stopped operating in Russia, stopped selling their products in Russia, and stopped working with Russian partners. In short, the backlash is vast. Which brings us to this country, to Britain. Last week, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced sanctions on over 100 Russian people and entities in response to the Russian invasion. He told the House of Commons on Wednesday that more were likely to follow.
Mr. Speaker, it's not appropriate for me to comment on individual cases at this stage. But what I can say, I stand, Mr. Speaker, by what I've said in the House and what we've put on the record. Be in no doubt that the actions that we've already taken, that this House has already taken, are having an effect in Moscow. And by exposing the ownership of properties of companies in the way that we are, by sanctioning 275 individuals, already a further 100 last week, the impact is being felt. And what we will publish in addition, Mr. Speaker, is a full list of all those associated with the Putin regime. Of course, we have already announced sanctions on Putin and Lavrov themselves. I can tell the House that they will have heard what the President of the United States had to say last night. The vice is tightening on the Putin regime, and it will continue.
Boris Johnson speaking during Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday. I'm joined now by Justin Cohen, news editor at The Jewish News. And Justin, the Prime Minister talked in that clip on Prime Minister's questions about publishing a full list of those associated with the Putin regime there. But we don't yet know who's on that list yet, do we?
We don't. There's obviously significant speculation that has been all week about who might be on that list. Many of them are members of the Jewish community, potentially. We've already had a very clear statement from Michal Friedman, one of the founders of the Genesis Philanthropy Group, that does contribute significant funds to the community and has really boosted the community in many different ways. He has made it clear that he's going to fight sanctions already issued in the EU. And one would assume that if he is sanctioned in the UK as well, as many speculate that he might be, the same would be the case here. He is very clear in his statement that, first of all, he doesn't have these links, these extensive links to Putin. And second of all, he's also, to his credit, it has to be said, distanced himself from the actual conflict itself and said that war can never be the answer. He was actually the first person to do that in the national press earlier this week.
And we reported that in the Jewish News, in our newspaper and online as well. And it's worth noting that this podcast is sponsored by an organisation supported by Russian Jewry. You've named it the Genesis Philanthropy Group. It is pointless, isn't it, really, to speculate about the names who would be on that British sanctions list until we've read the British sanctions list. And that list isn't ready for us to look at yet. But the list will contain, it will lay out the extent to which British people and British organisations will not be permitted to work with Russia. And given the number of links that exist between the Jewish community in this country, in Britain, and Jewish communities in Russia, this has the potential to be quite extensive and have quite a significant impact on the British Jewish community here, doesn't it?
It does. As you've said, the support of a number of Russian Jewish philanthropists to UK Jewry, to education, to community life, to religious life, is extensive. It is. And if some of these figures are listed for sanction in the UK, the impact on community funding won't be insignificant as a result of that. We're just going to have to see, though, whether these people are on there. As I said, that they, some of them, at least, have already publicly contested the idea that they should be. We'll see what happens.
We will see what happens. And we've also been talking about this in the leading article of this week's edition of the print edition of the Jewish News. Let's turn to the UK and the fundraising effort that's been happening, because there has been unanimous condemnation really across the Jewish community in this country of what has been happening in Ukraine as a result of the Russian invasion. Multiple Jewish agencies have been running emergency fundraisers for Ukraine to help people there, in some cases to help them get out. And we heard a lot of them at the beginning of this episode. The amounts of money being raised has already crossed £1 million. That's quite something, isn't it? It just shows how much generosity there is in the British Jewish community and how much potential there is among people who want to help.
You mentioned the unanimity that we're seeing across the community, and I think that is extremely significant. We often talk about two Jews, three opinions and so on. That was challenged very heavily during the Corbyn era. But once again, we're seeing an absolutely clear, united voice from the community, from its leadership, against Putin, against what's going on in the name of Russia at the moment. And, you know, similarly, as you say, the community has come together to raise funds. The community is often at its best, I would say, at times of crisis in terms of helping people in need, both in the community, it should be said, and outside the Jewish community in those regions. We've had money from World Jewish Relief in particular have been raising funds to support their partners on the ground. That's probably the charity that has the strongest links, the strongest ongoing partnerships in Eastern Europe. They've raised well in excess of £1 million now. We also have the Tikva Orphanage and their UK support, which is extensive, also raising, I think, in excess of £1 million. And I think, you know, overall, my calculation is that over £3 million has been raised just from the British Jewish community already in support of Ukrainians. And people can just go to our website, jewishnews.co.uk, to see a full list of the different fundraising appeals that are taking place and how to support them.
And we've also got a full list in this week's print edition of the paper as well, haven't we, of all the charities that are raising funds for Ukraine. £3 million, that's quite a substantial amount of money to be raised in the space of a week. And as we've been hearing earlier in the podcast as well, despite the difficulties in getting money into Ukraine at the moment, it will be incredibly useful, not just with the immediate disaster relief, but with rebuilding if and when the fighting actually ends over there. Justin, for the moment, thank you very much for that. And that's it from the Jewish News podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group. Through its partners, GPG is working to support the growth of Jewish community life in the UK and worldwide. To find out more, visit gpg.org. All that's left for me to do is to offer my thanks to all my guests from Ukraine and here in London, to Leo Mandel for his work in post-production, and to you for listening. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast app. That way you'll hear any previous episode or be informed when new episodes become available. Don't forget that for more information on any of the stories that we've featured, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. And if you'd like to comment, that we'd love to hear from you on editorial@jewishnews.co.uk or find us on social media. From me, Michael Daventry, do join us next time here on the Jewish News podcast. Goodbye.